deaths, with 45 states reporting an increase in week-over-week cases. The U.S. broke its record for hospitalizations for the 14th consecutive day, with nearly 86,000 COVID-19 patients hospitalized coast to coast. Medical workers around the U.S. are growing increasingly exhausted as hospitals fill to capacity and supplies of personal protective equipment run dry. Gene Ross, president of National Nurses United, spoke in a conference call Monday.
Nearly 1 year into this pandemic, our hospitals are knowingly still not prepared. Our latest survey of nurses showed that more than 80% of hospitals have done no surge capacity planning. And the Trump administration has explicitly stated it is not even trying to contain the virus.
To see our full interview with Gene Ross, you can go to democracynow.org. Hospitals are warning of an even more dire situation ahead, with millions of Americans ignoring the Centers for Disease Control's recommendation against traveling for Thanksgiving. On Monday, the Transportation Security Administration said over 3 million people traveled by air over the weekend, the busiest three-day period since last March. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom and his family have gone into quarantine after his children were exposed to a member of the Highway Patrol who contracted the coronavirus. Governor Newsom also apologized Monday after photos emerged of him flouting his own coronavirus guidelines while attending a dinner party at an exclusive French restaurant in Napa November 6. Newsom was photographed wearing no mask and seated in a tight cluster of people that included the chief executive of the California Medical Association and the group's top lobbyist.
I made a mistake being with a few extra people beyond the guidelines that I've been promoting, which is outside the households. That was a mistake. And I let my guard down and I apologize for it.
Meanwhile, the number of COVID-19 cases among members of President Trump's inner circle continues to rise. Donald Trump Jr. announced Friday he tested positive for coronavirus the previous Monday. Don Jr. was among some 250 people who packed the East Room of the White House on election night, almost none of them wearing masks. Ben Carson, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, said Friday he'd been desperately ill with COVID-19 but was recovering. Dr. Carson said his condition improved at Walter Reed Medical Center after President Trump intervened on his behalf. Carson wrote on Facebook, quote, President Trump was following my condition and cleared me for the monoclonal antibody therapy that he had previously received, which I'm convinced saved my life. Dr. Carson is just one of a handful of people able to access Regeneron's therapeutic before the FDA granted the drug emergency use authorization last Saturday. The treatment continues to remain in short supply, with Regeneron saying it will ship doses for 80,000 patients by the end of November. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong and two fellow campaigners face up to 3 years in prison after pleading guilty to charges related to inciting and organizing a massive protest last year against a proposed extradition bill with China. Opposition to the bill triggered months of ongoing protests across Hong Kong. This is Joshua Wong speaking to the press Monday.
I'm persuaded neither prison bars, nor election bans, nor any other arbitrary power will stop us from activism. What we are doing now is to explain the value of freedom to the world.
In Somalia, at least 4 people are dead after Tropical Cyclone Gati made landfall Sunday. The storm was poised to drop 2 years' worth of rain in 2 days. It's the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the northern Indian Ocean and to hit Somalia. It rapidly intensified as it approached eastern Africa. This comes as scientists say this is happening more frequently as storms are given a boost by the rising ocean temperatures fueled by the climate crisis. New details have emerged about why U.S. prosecutors dropped narco-trafficking and money laundering charges against Mexico's former defense minister, Salvador Cienfuegos. Reuters reports Attorney General William Barr agreed to drop the charges after Mexican officials privately promised him they would arrest a senior cartel leader involved with trafficking large quantities of the synthetic opioid fentanyl. The Drug Enforcement Administration had accused General Cienfuegos of protecting the violent H2 drug cartel while directing Mexico's army against its rivals. Authorities in Florida have opened an investigation into the recent police killing of two black teenagers who were shot at least eight times while driving a car in Cocoa, Florida, at around 10:30 a.m. November 13th. One passenger in the car survived. Attorney Benjamin Crump is now representing the families of 16-year-old Angelo Crooms and 18-year-old Sincere Pierce. Crump said the teenagers were terrified and tried to drive around the officers who were aiming guns at the car. The officers were following the car because they thought it had been stolen, but in fact, the car belonged to the girlfriend of one of the teenagers. In Omaha, Nebraska, protests continue over the weekend after two Omaha police officers shot dead Kenneth Jones, a 35-year-old black man, during a routine traffic stop Thursday. Police smashed in the passenger window where Jones was sitting and attempted to drag him out of the car before opening fire. According to a police press release, the officers continued to yell at Jones to show his hands even after they had shot him. In California, San Francisco District Attorney Jason Boudin has filed homicide charges against a police officer who shot dead an unarmed black man in 2017. The officer, Christopher Samayoa, shot Keita O'Neill from inside his patrol car after a chase. Boudin is believed to be the first San Francisco District Attorney to ever file homicide charges against an officer. In Kentucky, a leader of the movement demanding justice for Breonna Taylor has been fatally shot. 21-year-old Hamza Travis Nagdi was reportedly struck by multiple bullets during a suspected carjacking early Monday near the University of Louisville campus. Police have released few details and have not named a suspect. Nagdi was well known for leading chants over his bullhorn at Black Lives Matter events, demanding the officers who shot and killed Breonna Taylor in her own home last March be charged with murder. He voted for the first time just 3 weeks ago in the November 3rd election. In Tacoma, Washington, the immigrant rights group La Resistencia is reporting at least seven prisoners at Northwest Detention Center have gone on hunger strike following the alleged assault earlier this week of a 19-year-old prisoner when a guard reportedly put their knee on the teen's neck. At least four others were placed in solitary confinement in retaliation for speaking up against the attack, according to the group, including a 62-year-old prisoner who has cancer and other serious health problems. This comes as prisoners continue to fight for their release during the pandemic. This is Gabby Parra Perez, one of the hunger strikers, speaking from Northwest Detention Center, where she's been imprisoned for nearly a year.
I want to be released to be able to deal with this with my family. At 26 years old, I should not be having high cholesterol. I should not be having half of these medical issues that I have only because I have been in here. It is not mandatory for us to be in here. Half of the people that are still here don't have a single thing on their criminal record. Others, they've lived in the United States for more than 25 years. And so I know that it's not independently of what a judge has said, ICE has a decision to let us all go.
In more immigration news, the New York radio station WNYC reports nine immigrants being held at the Bergen County Jail in New Jersey have been on hunger strike for nearly 2 weeks. The prisoners are demanding their release amidst growing concerns over the spread of COVID-19 in the crowded and squalid jail. Several of them have health problems, including kidney disease, making them more vulnerable to worsening COVID symptoms. General Motors is recalling some 7 million pickup trucks and SUVs worldwide to replace potentially dangerous airbags. This comes after the U.S. government ordered GM to recall the vehicles, which GM maintains are safe to drive. Meanwhile, the automaker's withdrawn support for the Trump administration's years-long efforts to block California from establishing its own fuel efficiency standards. The New York Times reports GM's move signals the company is ready to work with President-elect Joe Biden and reducing climate warming emissions from cars and trucks. In Puerto Rico, the beloved social leader Carlos Taza Zenon died at the age of 84 last Friday. He was a longtime activist who for decades led the fight against the U.S. Navy's occupation of the island of Vieques, his hometown, where the U.S. government tested weapons and held military training exercises. Between 1978 and 83, Zenon and other fishermen repeatedly confronted U.S. Navy ships and halted planned military exercises. The Navy finally left Vieques in 2003 after bombing it with napalm for years. and former New York City Mayor David Dinkins has died at the age of 93. Dinkins was elected New York's 106th mayor in 1989, defeating Republican challenger Rudy Giuliani to become the only African-American ever to hold the position. During his 4 years in office, Dinkins expanded the size of New York's police force to record levels. He also backed the movement against apartheid in South Africa, ordering the city to divest its pension fund from companies doing business there. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday will have some snow and a high of 1 degree Celsius. Thursday will be mainly cloudy with a high of 4 degrees Celsius. Friday will continue mainly cloudy with a high of 5 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be rainy with a high of 4 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be mainly sunny with a high of 4 degrees Celsius. Monday there will be rain with a high of 5 degrees Celsius. Tuesday there will be scattered showers and a high of 1 degree Celsius. Well, it's time to wrap up the show. Stay safe, be well, and have a good week. Stay tuned to CKUT.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it... Thank you.
A few months ago, when all of the Rabble staff members were talking about what we could do to focus on the effects of COVID, our editor-in-chief, Matt Demera, suggested that I put together a podcast series focusing on Canada's emerging artists. The series you'll hear over the next 6 weeks is exactly that. I was surprised by what I've discovered. I expected mostly to hear stories about economic insecurity and fear. And for sure, that element is there. These are scary times for all of us. But I was surprised and happy to hear a hopefulness, a sense of resilience, and even a few cases where the shutdown has been good for our guests' art. Despite the devastatingly difficult times, good things are also happening.
Damn, like it's not an easy time right now, and I think it's really, really important that we, you know, can have conversations and dialogue, but also like have room for like each other.
I'm starting the series today with music and an interview with Maya Gomez. She describes herself this way. Singing from the raw, Maya Gomez is a mixed Indigenous urban artist who writes from the most honest parts of the human condition, hoping to bridge gaps for her audiences and tell her stories. Maya strives to connect with people through her powerful voice and emotion. Maya's from Waterloo and the Ottawa Valley, and she's now living in Toronto. We did this interview a few weeks ago, just before our competition she refers to. She was nominated for an Indigenous Music Award in the music video competition for novice artists. Spoiler, she placed third. Here now is my interview with Maya Gomez, beginning by talking about the elephant in the room.
For the first little while of COVID, I kind of just stopped everything. I think my mental health kind of took a toll because I really had a lot of plans for this year. And there's a story in my head that is from a long time ago that, like, you know, life always gets in the way. And I think that's a pretty common thing. But for me, I think it's been a very reoccurring thing. So now, so I had to work through all that. And in the past couple months, it's been great. I've, you know, worked within the means and gotten a few different things out. I've worked around not being able to be close to anybody as effectively as possible. It kind of made me have to pull inward too and look at, like, some of my skills and what do I want to improve a lot more than before. So I think I've been all right, just trying to maintain busyness in the best ways.
Are you trying to make a living full time doing music, or are you doing the sort of mixed revenue model?
I love creating. I think if I could financially make my life music and performance, whether that be theater, film, directing, producing, music. I think music is just kind of my constant. I always end up back at it. I may go over here for a little bit and try something, but music is kind of that always thing. And it always kind of has been, whether I was trying to make money at it or not. But yes, I'd love to be able to do it. It just hasn't been financially practical yet. And especially now, like, I'm kind of happy in some ways that I did have those trades right now, because the way that you would make music, you know, is go play live shows or like generally. So I think that I'm really excited about, but I would love to be able to create and make music and make art for a living.
Right. So has your work being a hairdresser, then that's enabled you to keep body and soul together, like, economically, or has that taken a hit during COVID as well?
That took a hit. I actually haven't really been cutting hair in a salon for probably over a year to 2 years. I left the profession because I realized that the reason why I was in it was because I kept trying to do music. I would find these hairdressers that were deeply creative but also musicians, and I just wanted to be around them. I enjoy doing hair, but, like, it's not the be all and end all for me. And it's a very tiring job. It's hard on your mental in a different way. So, and body too, right? I find that, yeah. And it's actually a weirdly limiting job because you're always trying to, you know, please the client, and it's about customer service. And it's not really where my dreams lie, but it's a great career. It's just not one that I've felt 100% passionate in. So I'm starting to, you know, pursue more of the arts, I think, that way.
Because of COVID, I would imagine it's been even more difficult for you to pursue a living in music without the live performance element. Or have your recordings and your music videos been able to sort of propel you forward?
So, no, I still work a part-time job. Within the past month or two, I've been landscaping. And then in my evenings, I do all music. I've had some music where, you know, they've been collabs with other people where I just, like, write with them. And that has been doing fairly well financially. But the rest of it, like, my stuff, you know, I'm still kind of creating and finding who I am. And I think that will come with, you know, an album and a bigger work project and finding my sound even more. And I think this year was tough because I, you know, I had goals. I was in school for production, and that kind of got cut short. So I think the goals that I had for this year, moving into possibly a financial career in music has, it's been halted a little bit, but time and just trying to keep my goals at the forefront and trying to find different ways and changing my approach and how to do it, I think has been good. I've been accepted into a music video competition. I don't really know if it's necessarily the same kind of award as like the main awards that they do, just because I don't know really what's going on with those types of things this year. But yes, I have been acknowledged and accepted into that process. And I am so excited, just because that video is my first video.
Really?
And
that's amazing. It's really, really polished and it's excellent. So I'm wondering, did you go into video making partly because there aren't any live performances opportunities available, or, you know, did COVID have anything to do with you transitioning and doing a video like that?
Not really. I love video. I've always loved video. Whenever I write a song, the way I write is, you know, the melody and the chord changes, everything, it all comes together at the same time, the words, and it almost plays like a movie in my head. So I think video just kind of comes naturally to my process. It's like I always think about the video as it's happening, which is kind of weird. But that video specifically, Take My Hand, took so much because I wanted it to look good. But I also really spent a lot of time on the story. Like, it was me and Will Snyder, who's he's fantastic. And we spent a lot of time going back and forth about what that would look like, what I'm trying to say, and very much about why am I doing this. So it was really important to me that looked the way that it did in my head. And a lot of things went wrong because it was my first video and I learned a lot. But I was really happy with the outcome.
Can you tell us sort of what the inspiration and the story and the motivation behind the creation of that video was?
So initially I wrote the song. I have to kind of, they all kind of go together for me. So I wrote the song a day where I was having a crazy bad mental health breakdown in front of somebody who was just trying to track a few of my demos. I didn't really know him all that well, but I was breaking down. I worked really hard and I had all this build up, and he had a beautiful way of just being really present with me in that moment. And I really saw myself in him, and he saw, I believe, himself represented through what I was experiencing at that moment. And for all intents and purposes, the best way to say it is essentially he saved my life. And it was a crazy moment. I went back and I started working. I immediately felt this need to touch my guitar. When I got home, I was in tears. It was not pretty. It was one of those really ugly cries, you know? And that song happened.
Night.
That was Take My Hand by Maya Gomez. We're talking to her today on My Art Wears a Mask, a Rabble.ca series with some of Canada's emerging artists and how they're doing during COVID. The song is also a music video and was a third prize winner in the Indigenous Music Awards music video category just last month. Here's the second part of our interview.
So, jumping to the video, most emotional songs for myself. And something that I felt other people could relate to. So I thought it was worth the investment of putting a little bit of money into a video. Also, we did that video real cheap. If you know anything about film, oh my gosh, It is not cheap. And I got that video because I was really clear on the direction and what I wanted and how I wanted and who I wanted and I was really clear on that. So we did it really cheap for video. But the video itself, I really wanted just to be clear on the arc of, you know, she sees herself in this person. And he sees her in that moment where she feels completely alone and distant. And I just wanted there to be more importance on that moment and what they shared and the fact that you don't know what another person is going through, even when they're, you know, trying to help you out, I think. And just, it's almost like that reminder to get out of your own head sometimes and be present with what's going on in the moment, because you don't know when it's going to end. And yeah, that friend shared with me some very personal things about his own mental illness. And, you know, it's in the song and you can hear it. And I was just really, I felt it was important to make a video for, and I hope people like it or feel something. I don't even care if necessarily people like it. I just hope they feel something when they actually fully watch the thing, you know?
When did you actually write the song and when did you produce the video? What was the time between those two events?
I'm trying to remember because I believe that the video happened in January, near the end of December it started, and then we finished it in January. The creation of the song and up into the creation of like the actual track probably only took a few months, and that was in 2019. Like, I moved pretty quickly on it because I believed in it. I still do, but at the time it just felt so viscerally important. I played it like a few times live just to get feedback, and get like an understanding of how people were relating to it. And then I just did it. Like, it was really quick. I believed in it and I needed it out of me. I have this weird thing where there are some things that I like to sit with for a really long time. And then there are certain things where it's like, whew, all right, that's out now.
So that was a pre-COVID production. You pretty much had it finished by the time COVID hit. I'm wondering how your work and your output has changed since COVID has started.
So I can talk about I Can't Breathe, because that was during COVID.
Yeah, that one was really powerful. You talk about feeling things viscerally. It's like what occurred to me while I was watching I Can't Breathe, it's not just about, you know, it's about the anxiety of our entire time right now.
So there's a lot to unpack with I Can't Breathe. One, I started it right near, like probably a few months into this experience that we're in right now. And the song itself I wrote three, almost 4 years ago now. And it was, you know, about my own experiences. You know, I write at the top of it kind of my explanation of that. My own experiences, you know, trying to heal from intergenerational traumas, PTSD, parents with PTSD, all of those things, and being in abusive relationships in the past, and not healthy relationships. And racism, all the fun things that this time seems to be magnifying. So then when I was working on this, I sent it to Anthony King, who is fantastic. He's a guitar player for Buffy St. Marie, who is one of my idols, but and just talented
But he himself is, I've always loved what he's done with her music live. So I sent him a song and I was like, hey, could you produce this? Could you work on it? Maybe add a solo, like do something, you know, with it. And he liked it. And so probably a week later, then all the stuff happens with George Floyd. And
so it was completely coincidental that you called the song I Can't Breathe and then the George Floyd.
Yeah.
So that I had thought the song was a response to that, but that's amazing.
No, it was about, I mean, it was initially the song was written, me just saying, like, I was going through really bad, felt like I was in a suffocating situation. And I also, you know, was dealing with the effects of my mom's relationship to police and all of that stuff that happened in my life. So yeah, I wrote that and then I sent it to Anthony. And then literally like the week later, a week to 2 weeks later, George Floyd died. And then all of a sudden the song grew. It's the best way to put it. It became something more visceral. All of a sudden I'm witnessing everywhere on all of my social media, not to mention, not only was this happening, there was a lot of stuff happening like on reservations and heightened police things like maybe a few months before that. So I'm just in this world of like reliving a lot of my own trauma all the time on every platform I have. I was just always witnessing it. So I was sending myself through this like mental health crisis again and again and again. So that's where my narrative in that video comes from. It's that I'm always, it's like no matter what, I'm always going to be witnessing these kinds of things and having to interpret them and learn from them and acknowledging my own responsibility within them, because not only am I, you know, I am an Indigenous woman, but I also, you know, do have settler ancestry and I do present white, so I have to acknowledge a certain amount of that, right? So it was that and dealing with that, and then also looking towards our future and looking at youth and how I can support in the best way possible these people that are struggling right now through my perspective.
Oh,
I filmed and edited this whole thing by myself. Like, and I've never done anything like that. Like, I am not a filmmaker.
You are now.
I am now. But, like, I'm not, you know what I mean? So it took a lot. Like, I didn't know how to use editing software, really. So I was trying my best. I hope it came through. I spent a lot of time crying. There's a clip in the video where I'm watching a protest happening. There's tear gas everywhere. And that's important to me. It doesn't matter necessarily, but that image was really important for me. But like that video is me genuinely having a panic attack watching this. It's not, you know, me acting sad. And I think that was really important because it's a really messed up time. And there's a lot of high emotion, lots of anger, lots of pain, lots of confusion, ignorance. I mean, damn, like it's not an easy time right now. And I think it's really, really important that we, you know, can have conversations and dialogue, but also like have room for like each other, you know? And I think that video during COVID, like, you know, all those dancing shots and everything, like that was done in an open space. Whereas I might not have done it quite the same had I not been able, or had I been able to do it in a way that was like, you know, a little more intimate. but I also thought it was important because, you know, my story is urban. I'm not from a res. I lived on a res for 6 months to 8 months of my life. I wanted to be authentic in every aspect of that video because I think it's important. Yeah. So I spent a lot of time making sure that I was really clear on what the point was. And the point, honestly, of that video is just like, you know, everyone's path is different to healing and we all need to make room for it and support each other. That was my goal with that. And also, you know, mental health, I think, is the most important thing. It's one thing I'm very clear. It needs to be a focus, especially in these communities.
Right now, as you talk, it makes me realize just how important human connections are to you. It's like, how are you dealing with it? That, I mean, it's editing video is a solitary pursuit. So in some ways, being stuck in, you know, in our homes and editing video and doing our electronic media stuff and everything is a good way to use the time. But it's like you're a very social person. You talk about you're wanting to touch other people with your work. How are you doing that in this time of isolation?
I really wish that I could say that I was doing a really good job at it. It's weird because I love human connection, but I also am a really, really introverted person in a lot of ways. So when it comes to music, I love playing live. I love it. It's my favorite thing. It's the whole reason I do it. I don't necessarily always need like day-to-day small chat, small talk. I like in-depth conversations. So I find that I kind of have been okay that way. But for the music, I'm really limited because it's not my favorite thing to do live streams. It's not my favorite thing to play to my computer screen. I feel like it feels empty. It feels a little bit shallow, but it's the only way I have to connect right now. So I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do my best to make people feel as comfortable and as honest as I can be within that discomfort. We got to make it work. And I'm going to do my best, but it's not my favorite thing. I love being in a bar or whatever where I can see people's like reactions, even if it's negative. It's just like it's super important to me. And it's the one thing about video that like I do struggle with because I can't see people's responses when they watch it. And it's like, I care about how people interpret things, but I also don't care. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I want to be able to have dialogue about this. So I'm really happy that we're talking.
Yeah, I'm happy that we're talking too. Looking ahead, I mean, what's the way through? Do we just have to give up the idea that we can do any planning, or, you know, like, yeah, what's the way through?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I don't know. I hope there is one. I'm setting up plans because I'm not really content with just going, well, this is the way it is. I guess I'll just, you know, pack her in. Because my brain doesn't function that way. But I think it's okay to make plans. I just think you got to be realistic about those plans might not work out. And I think you should kind of be like that in any time. And you have to be open to the ability to readjust and to find a new approach. I mean, I would probably say reapproach, and still make plans, just maybe take into account the situation as it stands and how you may need to alter what that might look like. I mean, even for me, like, I'm going to be shooting something coming up, and there's a part in it, it's a little bit more of like a there's like an interview part, and before we had planned for it to be, you know, that he's interviewing me and we're sitting there and we're able to talk, and now we have him via Skype on a computer screen and I have to look at the computer screen, but he'll be in another room filming me. Like, it's just, you have to make it kind of work. And somebody said this, and I don't remember who. It's not about the resources, how resourceful you are with what you have. And so, I mean, I've never had a lot, and I'm still trying to figure that out. And yeah, I think if you want it, if you want whatever you want, there's always going to be a way to do it. You just may have to make some compromises and look at what is actually available to you.
And what about the economic piece of it? Because it's like, you can't do live shows. That's a big part of a musician's income. How do you keep, you know, body and soul together and food on the table at this time?
I mean, what's been great is that there are still a decent amount of like online streaming events. And I will say, like, as much as I'm a little bit, they're not as immediately enjoyable for me, I will say that they are great for the simple fact of being able to get stuff out to people and still being able to connect in some way. It's like the thing of, like, kind of what I said, you have to be able to adjust. You may not be comfortable, but you got to be able to. And there are corporations, not corporations, but like, you know, groupings, Facebook groups, all these things that are doing live streams, that are paying artists for those things. So I've been really lucky that way. Yeah. And I think I've also just kind of been lucky so far. And I'm at the very beginnings of, you know, my creations and stuff. I've been very lucky that I've been able to jump into some of those and the ones that I want to and try my hand at it. So I think, I think I've just been lucky with that. But financially, it can be tough, especially if, like, let's say you were playing the 3 bars a week, you know, same bar, and they were paying you every night, right? Like, that's a lot of income that is now gone. And, but I believe OAC had a, like, a financial support.
Ontario Arts Council, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They had an emergency fund. A few others did too. So it's out there. It's not, you know, it's not super glamorous, but I don't know.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM. FM. Are you recording?
You are?
Oh. Can you press stop?
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT. We're on the air. Live. CKUT.
We're listening to 90.3 FM.